Good evening, everybody. The recording has started. It's exciting. Shmuel Plotkin coming at you live from our Gulf Manor Synagogue School of Jewish Studies. It's Tanakh Tuesday, and we are continuing our weekly study of 1 Kings. We're still in Chapter 11. My voice is slowly getting a little bit better. Not that much, but at the moment I'm feeling better. Thank God. I'm actually feeling better, so that's good. The voice is always the last thing to come back. We left off last week at or around verse 15. We completed the study of verse 15. So you know what we're going to do for Chazara's sake and for continuity's sake. I'm going to read in English a couple of verses, and that will catch us up, give us a little bit of a narrative, and that will wing us right in where we want to go. And we'll continue with new, fresh material, and plenty of it tonight. Let's do that. Let's take a look at verse 9. I know it's sending us back a lot, but if we're going to just do it in English, it'll take a minute. I'll do the English reading of the Psukim from verse 9 to 14 or 15, and then that'll set the stage for our new material tonight. So take a look at verse 9. Hashem became angry with Shlomo because his heart had digressed from God. I'm reading at you almost word for word from the Judaica Press and its translation. God became angry with Shlomo because his heart had turned away, deviated, digressed from God, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him, to Shlomo, twice. Verse 10, and that was Hashem who had commanded him pertaining this matter not to follow other gods. However, he did not keep what God had commanded. Verse 11. So God said to Shlomo, for as this has been with you, and you have not observed my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I'll surely tear the kingdom from you, and I'll give it to your servant. Verse 12. However, in your days, I won't do this. For the sake of David, your father, from the hands of your son, I shall tear it. But not from you while you're alive, because I loved your father so much. Verse 13, but I shall not tear the entire kingdom away from you. One tribe I will grant to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen. Wow, you know, the Almighty is so merciful toward him. Why? Laman David Avicha. Laman David Avdi. So it's well within our, I'm not going to say our rights, but it's well within the purview of good sense to appeal to the Almighty in memory and out of respect for King David, whom the Almighty had such a love for. Look at that. I'm not going to hammer you in your lifetime for the sake of David, your father. I'm not going to tear away the whole kingdom from you because of David, my servant. I'm gonna hurt you, but whatever I do, I'm gonna temper it with love because I really, really loved your dad.
Well, not only that, but I guess he had to get his merit from somewhere because the life that he led was anywhere from
the life
that David Hamas led was anything from peaceful.
Right.
True. He got whacked constantly.
Right. True. He was really, truly in a state of constant persecution. I mean, near constant. One rabbi said that his life was just one bad thing after the other. So Hashem really just cutting him a break. So they're cutting Shlomo a break out of love of David. Excuse me, and it was thanks to all that persecution that we have the Book of Psalms, which everybody can relate to on one level or another as you go through life. And thank God for the Book of Psalms. And thank God for David. If David had not been persecuted and aggravated and punished and nonstop, would we have those gems that we have today? I hardly think so. Again, 13. God says to Shlomo, but I won't tear the entire kingdom away from you. One tribe I'll grant. One tribe I will grant to your son. He's talking to Shlomo. Your son's going to have one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I've chosen. Verse 14, so God raised up an adversary against Shlomo. His name was Hadad, the Edomite. He was of the royal lineage of in Edom. Not a very old kid, not a very old man. He was young when this was happening. We're going to see in a pasuk or two how old he was. Not exactly how old he was, but we'll get a better idea. Okay, 15. He was again the royal. He was of the royal lineage in Edom. 15, and it was when David was in Edom that Yoav, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain. When David was in Edom, and Yoav, the commander of the Jewish army, he went up to bury those who he had killed, since he had slain every male in Edom. Wow. So take a look. I don't know if you saw this in a footnote last week. We should definitely do it now. We did say it last week. He buried those who were killed. And Rashi, we said, we read it in English, they buried the slain of Edom. David made a name for himself. This is in 2 Shmuel. David made for himself a name when he returned from smiting Edomites. Everybody was praising him as a good man, as a kind man who buries his victims. So there he was. He and Yoav were busy slaying Edomites. What do they then do? They go back and they bury them. Wow. Now that's really something. Don't you think, people? He buries those whom he killed. And people said, wow, now there's a man for you. In American lingo, they might say, that's a stand-up guy. He kills his enemies, but doesn't let them lay out there in the field, which is so completely repulsive to God. God says to Klal Yisrael, when you have to execute somebody, do what you got to do, but then take the body and bury it properly and don't let it lay out there in the field, because that was a human being created in my image. I don't want you to just let it lay there, let the vultures get to it. That was once a functioning, breathing, thinking human being. Show a little respect to your fellow human being. And that's exactly what David did. It's really something. He returned from smiting the Edomites. Everybody was praising him as a kind man who buries his slain. It wouldn't be any great shakes had David buried Jewish victims, because he would have been biblically obligated to do that. And nobody would have said, there's a stand-up guy. His Jewish men get killed. So the general, king of the army, you know, emperor, I mean, he's the chief and commander, commander-in-chief, as we would say today, king and commander-in-chief, make sure that his Jewish dead get buried. Of course you expect that. That's his own men. But to go back and bury his victims, that's something. That's what he did. He buried the victims of the war that he fought. He killed his Edomites and he buried them. And people said, there's a man for you. That's a man for you. That's somebody you can respect. And so too, Pasuk in Yechezkel, we said it last week, regarding Melchemes Gog u'Magog. Even the preachers on the radio talk about this chapter. I know, because I listen every once in a while. I'm a nut. I always want to hear, what's the loyal opposition saying? Every so often they talk about, well, not the Catholics, they couldn't kill us about Hebrew prophecy. But the Protestants do. Historically, they always have cared about it. And so, Melchemes Gog u'Magog, Rashi quotes on the Pasuk, they will bury all the people of the land, and it will be for them for a name. Meaning, Klal Yisrael will be in Israel. In come the bad guys. God wipes them out. There they are, laying strewn all over, dead, and the Jewish people are going to bury them. Pasuk says, That's going to be up to the Jewish people. They're going to bury these guys. And people are going to say, that's a nation of stand-up guys for you. They bury their enemies. It's going to according to the Pesukim, it's going to take us months to do it. Those living in Israel, it's going to take them months to get rid of all the corpses. So says the Pesukim. They'll bury all the people of the land, and it'll be for them for a name. All right. And one last thing, he slew every male in Edom. I was telling somebody recently, and now, did I say it last week too? Now you know why they don't learn Tanakh in the yeshivas. Because, I remember reading this as well, the military aspect of ancient Israel is virtually on every single page. On every single page, Jewish people are fighting. Moshe's fighting the Midianites. And Amalekites, and Og, and then comes Yoshua, he's fighting, and then they're fighting the locals, and the Canaanites, and come the Plishtim, and the Jews are fighting the Plishtim, and they're fighting nonstop and Sefer Shoftim, never ends, and comes Shmuel, and David's fighting them, and now here we are again in the Book of Kings. It is one military escapade after the other. And according to what I read, you can understand that Jews in a shtetl in Europe, who had absolutely no ability to fend for themselves, couldn't fight if their lives depended upon it, and often did, and they didn't do very well, sadly. And here they are reading about ancient Jewry, not just picking up swords and spears and arrows and shields, but winning. I mean, like killing people. And doing pretty well. And so according to this, it was so incongruous for the rabbis of the day, for centuries, in Europe, to read this material. And after all, war became associated with the Goyim. Bad people fight wars. And we're the victims. And we don't have any armor. We don't have any fighting ability. Goyim pick on us. Goyim pick up guns. Goyim, well, spears, shields, swords. Goyim do all that terrible stuff. We don't do that stuff. So the cognitive dissonance between picking up a Sefer Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Beis, Malachim, was so overwhelming that they said effectively, we're going to just kind of conk out on all this Tanakh study because it's just not working out. How can you have all these Jews, you know, 2 millennia ago, 3 millennia ago, they're fighting and fighting victoriously, and we today are not even a shadow of that. So they just basically, according to this, kind of really tamped down all the study of the Bible and ramped up the study of the Talmud and associated warfare with the Goyim, with the bad people. Take it or leave it. That's what I read. And then maybe something too, because like, we're always kind of going along those lines. And if that doesn't work for you intellectually, come up with something that does, because I think it makes some sense. Brother, what do you got?
Okay, we read it, but I would 100% agree with it.
They fight war.
Right. Well, you have those that controversy in Chazal. You had it was it the last parsha or so that with Bilam, you know, that when Bilam was using the Jewish method to try to put down the Jews, namely Tfila, Tfila. And so therefore, to protect, the Jews were retaliated by using the Goyish method against Bilam and his ilk. There's a Rashi in I forget, Matar to Matar, it's built with Bilam the Baruch Hargu B'charet. And he says that either there or good, maybe I'll accept that. When one of the last couple of verses, it was there, and Rashi says it very explicitly. So we definitely, this concept is there, it's there.
The Bill of attacks us with his mouth.
Right.
We fight back with.
With war, with and warfare. This is role reversal, very explicitly. You have the same idea, not of the reversal, but of the respective roles of the Birchas Yaakov, and then. With when Esav gets a bracha, but beyond that, this is a galactic kosher a glut kosher a concept. Why? Because Rav Henkin says, I think I told you this in private conversation, I don't know if I ever said it out at in a recorded shiur, that he says for precisely the reason that you say, and it goes a step further, that in order not to get the dander up, I'll use it as another expression, of the goyim, we want to remove the identification with militaristic ideal as far as much remove it as possible from the Jewish people. And then he says something very interesting, which I found fascinating, writing, of course, in Hebrew. He says, and to the extent that we do learn Tanakh, that those sections of Tanakh that refer to the military exploits and similar, he says that if I'm not quoting him exactly, it's very close. Hashem should give me the strength to remember. He says, at the time when we do learn it, Ruach shall mistarin chofeis aleihem. The spirit of that mystery, of mystique, of something unreal, unworldly, hovers over them. In other words, there is a kind of cloud of unreality that is deliberately, apparently, encouraged by, I presume, the Gedolim, who have directed the study of these things, in order for us to not feel that we're part of that world in any direct or literal sense. Isn't that powerful words, though?
Right. Let's see if I got it clear. You say the Ruach, a mysterious, mystique-oriented Ruach spirit hovers over the great ones, and that inspired them to tamp down the study of these portions of the Bible, and that was like divinely inspired.
He doesn't say it. I think he would say it. He would agree. But the Ruach Shem is stirring. He's in the media says he's referring not to the background, what directed them to do that, but at the time, the actual study, when we were relating to it, we're not relating to it, our Zadie, what made a war, was successful in this war, and bring the banner, hold that banner high of war, and, Neshkidel Hayasham, Bilu, Maccabi, that we're chuckling Zach in the base medrash. We're finding all kinds of non-literal ways of interpreting some of these things. The nigun, maybe we use the word nigun, I'm not sure. Remember, and I think that Rev Hankin probably, in the title of hearts, might agree. I have to be careful not to put things into what he says that he doesn't say, but the thing that I've also said about the clearly, explicitly, heard the name of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, the Chronicle of Bracha, when he said, that says anybody who says that David didn't sin is just simply making a mistake. David says he didn't sin, but we're not allowed to say it, that there is some barrier, almost a hedge of roses, taken from another context in Judaism, a hedge of roses placed between the literal historical truth and the way we are to relate to it.
Something to consider. I'd love to see that Rav Hankin.
So Juliana, I will find it for you.
Thank you, because
I'd love to create a small little study, perhaps, of that source. Rabbi Hankin is a source, and this little blog that I saw, and maybe some others, and try to just put together a small little mini study of that. I find it fascinating. I just do.
You don't know by chance the history of Hankin is there without.
No, okay. I do not. But that's very fine.
This is my bookshelf, the Berliner Air.
Thank you, Rabbi Berlov, is saying that we have to take a look at the Kol Kitfei Rav Hankin, volume 1.
Yeah.
By Miles, and so Rabbi Berlov will do the legwork, I sure do appreciate that. Berlin Edrin, he'll make an effort, and I thank him in advance for any help he can give. I find the whole thing just simply, personally, I find it beyond fascinating. I'm not gonna belabor this. I'm gonna just say that here we have biblical books. You learn them in fifth grade. You learn them in sixth grade. Maybe you still see them in seventh grade. At a certain point, that we stop, and you never really revisit them formally. And beyond that, we don't really study them anything formally. There's no formal study of Yeshaya, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. It's not.
In the modern Orthodox schools.
Okay, right. In modern Orthodox schools, you certainly will see some. That's true. Thank you. But in the Yeshivish circles, in the Hasidic circles, it's practically nil, effectively nothing there in any formal way. And if you saw anything inside formally, you did it from fourth grade to sixth grade. And maybe you got through small bays if you were lucky, and that's basically it. But even there, you saw some warfare, and we don't really revisit it. We don't make a big deal out of it, and you're not going to hear many drushes about it. And we just kind of poo-poo it. And the question is why. And this is one possible reason that I threw out, Rebbe threw out, and it's just fascinating. It just is, because it's biblical study, and it's just not the. I'm amazed at it. So here we go. Yeah.
Does that play into the authority at all to the authority take of the Israeli soldiers?
If you would have asked me in my very unlearned way, I would say yes. And yet, for centuries, my understanding is for a very, very long time, we've been devaluing the study of this or tamping it down, or associating warfare with the bad guyim, like this writer wrote, which I'm quoting from memory, and Rabrula felt that it's not terribly off by much, that there's something there, that we're associating warfare with the bad guys. of course, all that, how could it not play in to the last century, where you have secular Zionist soldiers fighting wars? And if I'm not mistaken, I thought that Rabbi Eilish and others in that camp are of the opinion that these wars are not milchamot mitzvah, but rather they're aggressive, wrong-headed, Zionistic, secular, semi-satanic wars that the Jews had absolutely no business being a part of, initiating, fighting in any way. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that that's coming from the Ungarische camp. That's my understanding, that that's where they're coming from. So yes, they're taking centuries of a certain way of looking at things and a certain tradition that's developed, and then poof, they're able to apply it exactly where they need it. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'd like to hear how I'm wrong, if I'm wrong. I think that they found that absolutely just beautifully, like a hand in a glove. Fighting is bad, Goyim are bad, fighting is bad, Zionists are bad, the fighting is bad. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but if I'm wrong, I want to hear how I'm wrong. I'll wait a minute and I'll hear the critique. Otherwise, we'll go forward. Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
Am I wrong?
No, sure you're wrong.
Of course I'm wrong.
Of course, why not? And the reason...
you got something?
Leave it over here.
Okay.
The reason is that very simply, whenever they did these wars, They didn't let everybody go out to fight. They only had the righteous people fight.
In ancient times.
Right. So any of the other wars where you have people that are not on that caliber, they shouldn't even be out there. So that's what the thing is, that maybe they're perfectly okay with the Rosh Hashivas going out, but not just the average people.
That's an interesting wrinkle. I never really even thought of that. Only great men back in the day fought. And if you were not holding, or if you were weak in your faith, and you were going to weaken other people, you had to get home. And we read about how the great scholars, I think, remember learning this, they were the ones who are actually out there fighting. So how do you make sense of that? I don't know.
I have two comments. One comment is that I would, respect partly to logic degree to your assessment. I know you're referring to the fact that the Torah says that before they go to war, there's like a whole speech where the Kohen Gadol gives right, and then it's weeding out those who this and that. Whoever has an Aveira Chazal tell us that these leaders were only referring to like an expansive war. When it comes to a defensive war, Hakol Ohochin, even the Kaaba B'chupas, whatever that means, but certainly everybody goes, these things don't apply. However, the interesting Spanish comment was, in terms of contemporary times, what are the circles today, in the last, I would say, the last 75 at least or more years, that do emphasize or do at least give due attention to this part of the Tanakh? It's the very circles that, whether they're fighting themselves or whether they're not fighting themselves, but they're supporting Zionism and so on, that do learn these things. When I was in Camp Moshava, I can assure you that a very big percentage of whatever time we did devote to learning, it was not a very big chunk of the day over there, I must say, in a Haredi camp, but I remember we had to come. It was the 35 seconds. It was on Nach. In fact, I seem to remember that when they gave us the list of what you had to bring to camp, you had to bring by Midbar or Devarim or both, depending on which part of the summer you're going, what they're reading the Torah. You had to bring that Chumash. And then you had to bring, I can't remember, it said either a Shmuel or a Malachim or something. I remember one year that was the standard learning for, I think it was every day for about 45 minutes. I don't know. We had a humongous group sitting there in the grass, and I don't know if anybody paid much attention. But
that's what you were learning.
Exactly. So that is a very big thing of Bnei Akiva, which of course is Bnei Akiva camp. I read, when I read the historical memoirs of Bnei Akiva, that for some years they pushed, they called it Perek Yomi, like before you go to bed or something, you should learn a Perek of Tanakh. You know, it's not exactly the same as what they would be pushing in Camp Aguda. And they had Mishnayos Be'alpeh, that was a big push, you know, and learning, and regular learning, of course, for anybody old enough to do it would be Gemara. So it's a very, very good approach. I don't think we had any one word of Nach there. But on the other hand, I think there's been a little bit of, I don't know, today, you went to, may I ask you, you were for high school in MPJ.
Yes.
Didn't they have like at between lunch and English or something a couple times a week, not nothing, not even that?
They did in the earlier grades.
Oh.
So up until 7th grade, 8th grade, you would have, some Tanakh from 12:30 to 1:15.
That kind of thing, right.
Once high school hit, my recollection is that there was no formal to not study at that point.
Let me ask you this. Typically, those yeshivas, learning goes to something like 2:30, right? Then you have mincha and English. So what do you, after lunch, like more gemara, or you had lighter things like chumash or haracha or something?
Lighter fare.
Right.
Lighter fare.
Right.
I don't recall learning a sefer of Tanakh in the high school years. It was gemara in the morning, and then maybe some halacha in the afternoon. And then before you know it, you're right into your English studies after the lunch thing. And
did English include Hebrew language for a region?
In ninth grade, it did.
They didn't chop some of that time to have a Rebbe teach it so they could chop a couple times a week to do Nach within that?
There was
so
a Rebbe
who
indeed taught it was a lot of grammar, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
I don't recall a sefer of Tanakh in conjunction with that. I don't think so. It was mostly a whole lot of just kind of grammar and very boring, and somehow I got through it. And then I went digital versus grammar. Actual class, they should have, in college, when I took intermediate Hebrew 1 and 2 at NYU, thank you very much, Professor Ross Brand, studied with us the story of Yosef and his brothers in conjunction with modern Israeli Hebrew
grammar, he also did a study of the biblical book of Genesis. We saw Yosef and his brothers. And that was an interesting, you know, combo. You're seeing the biblical way to express things, and we're learning that mom is really Hebrew. And it was just really, it was a great class. He was a great teacher. I don't recall that aspect, the biblical book in high school being studied alongside grammar. It was a chaval in a way. It should have done that person. At all events, thank you all for your thoughts on this. All right. Here we go. Let us now continue. We were just reviewing very quickly from last week. Shem raised up an adversary against, Yadalit. Let's read that again. God raised up an adversary against Shlomo. His name was Hadad, the Edomite, Adoni. Mizora Melech, Rube Adom. He was of the royal lineage in Edom, 15. So it was, when David was in Edom, that Yoab, the commander of the army, had gone up to bury the slain, since he had slain every male in Edom. We spent a few moments on this earlier, before some of you guys came in. What a stand-up guy he was. He kills the Edomites, then he buries them. That's a real good human being. And he gets a Yishakayach, and people speak highly of him. Now, fresh material, Pasuk Zion 16. Again, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 16. Ki sheshes chodashim yashav sham Yoab b'chol Yisrael. Yoab and all of Israel spent 6 months over there. Ad hichris kol zocha be'edom. Till he finished killing every single man that there was to kill in Edom. It took him 6 months to track down every Edomite male. He did that, and he killed them. It took him 6 months to do that. They were stationed there in Edom for 6 months till he killed everybody. Take a look at the footnote. Kisheshes chodashim yashav sham Yoav v'chol Yisrael. So the footnote is on page 123C. I'm going to be quoting a Radak. That is to say that all B'nai Yisrael who accompanied him in battle remained for 6 months. And for details, we got to go see the comments on 2 Samuel, chapter 8, verse 13. I'm not going to do it now, but I'm just letting you know that if you want to see more about this particular battle, see Shmuel Bey's chapter 8.
Now we consider a 6 month war
pretty short, right? Well, you know what? It's a funny thing to say, because am I not mistaken, but is it not the case that when Israel, when the state of Israel gets into a war, these guys know 6 months, that's almost an unbelievable amount of time to have to be fighting. That's almost unthinkable for Israel to be at war for 6 months. They try to get things done within 2 months.
In Israel, it doesn't last a long time.
Right.
But then again, Israel doesn't fight to the finish.
Right.
The world makes them stop when they start to win.
That's right. Mrs. Brolov is good. I hope you heard that. Israel doesn't really, cannot, I mean, how could it fight to the finish and encircle old Damascus and old Cairo? I mean, it could have, but it would have taken a lot of men to do that simultaneously in the Six-Day War. I was watching a video on that, and they were going into Egypt, and just when they're plowing through the Egyptian line, and it becomes very clear to Nasser that the jig is up, and they broke through, and he's incredulous, and he calls the Soviets, I guess, and they call the Americans, if I'm not mistaken, and okay, this war's got to stop right now. Okay, so they stopped the war. And the Israelis took over the Sinai Peninsula. They took over the Golan Heights. They didn't take over. Incredible. But they didn't, you know, they didn't fight to the death of every single last Syrian or every last Egyptian. Though they did certainly imprison quite a few of them. But they didn't have the manpower to do all that. Nor would the world, like you said, nor would the world allow them to do it. So just as they're winning, that's when the powers that be come down on them and say, enough's enough. You Jews have to now stop. You've won enough. Okay, 6 months. 6 months, America's at war in Afghanistan. Iraq, not so much, but still getting, never, still getting, taking casualties in Afghanistan since 9/11. That's like 18 years going. There's nothing left. That's a long war. That's what is that? I mean, forget World War One. What was that? 2 years of American involvement? Three? And World War II, 1941, 4 years of involvement, five, whatever it was. This is 18 years, incredible.
Yes,
incredible amount of time. Barry?
In World War II and a lot of other ones, two-thirds of the casualties were civilians. And I don't understand how for 6 months somebody can't hide out. When they have help, they have the women and children that will see them and whatever. Why they can't hide out for 6 months? I mean, it seems now people are able to hide out for 6 months, and they're looking for one guy, and they know when they'll get that one guy because they're only looking for one guy. They don't, you know, that seems an exorbitant amount of
6 months.
It seems 6 months a person can hide out.
Right.
They go in a cave, and how long did the person eat figs and stuff?
Interesting point you make. If I'm not mistaken, is it going to be at Blue Ash Chabad? They're going to show a movie called The Underground, The Tunnel. Jews went into a tunnel to avoid the Nazis. They spent like 2 years.
That Kishibar movie?
I think so. 2 years or three. I don't know which one the number is. But a very long time living in tunnels under the ground to avoid the Nazis. And when they came out and they saw sunshine, they hadn't seen that in a while. And the kids, like, they were raised in, like, these tunnels. They were just, okay, life is pretty bleak. It's pretty dark. It's a pretty dark life, you know, here on Earth. Meanwhile, I'm sure the stories were, maybe one day we'll get back up to the surface and you'll see the sunshine. Oh, you won't believe what you see. I mean, incredible thing to live underground for 2 to 3 years. So, Barry, I'm not sure what to say, but the pasuk says, he stayed there with all Israel until they killed every male in Edom. What can I tell you? 17. Yud Zayin. Vayivrach Adad. Huva Anashim Adomiyim. Me'avdei Aviv Ito Lavo Mitzrayim. Let's break that down. The verb levroach means to flee, to run away. So Adad, notice the spelling. 1 second he's called Hadad. This is not a big adilla, but I'm just curious. 1 second he's called Hadad in Yudalit. Then here in Yudzayin, he's called Adad with an Aleph. I know the Radak's going to give us a comment. I know that, yeah. And in the same Pasuk, he's then referred back again as Hadad. I find that curious.
Is this the same person?
It is. It is indeed. It is indeed the only one named Hadad/Adad. There's nobody else who's the subject of these psukim. He's the guy. And so take a look at your footnote where they're going to quote a Radak. Might as well maybe see him inside.
Oh, maybe after a fifth, after...
Yeah, take a look at the Radak, and I'll read it, and then prepare it. You're dying. V'yivrach Adad ba'alev v'acherim behei. Sometimes an olive, sometimes a hay.
Yeah, but didn't you tell us
that? It's the same thing. They get into. Excuse me. I'm getting over this well. Believe it or not, this is an improvement. Thank God. Aleph's and Hay's interchange. Yud's and Vav's interchange. The Radak says, calm yourself down. It's the same guy. Adad equals Hadad. Aleph, Hay, Zorg Zichnisht. Don't get so worried. It's the same guy. Barry? I never remember. Barry,
you told us that when you change it from like that, that has an effect on the personality, that it wasn't just interchange. There was a personality difference.
I'm not sure if I said that, but that's an interesting point. I don't know. That's an interesting thing. All I know is that the Spanish school, this rational, Pashut Pshat-oriented Radak, and others who follow in that Spanish tradition, I wonder if they'd go along with that interesting idea that when his personality changed, of course, 1 second it's called Adad, 1 second Hadad. I'm not sure about that, Barry. That's possible. But maybe, but I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm going to commit to that. Roll over to you now.
Okay, I just thought of an inside, a totally grammatical approach.
Yeah.
The one that's with the Dalit is in a phrase, we got to connect the word. A ches, the aleph, the one with the aleph.
No.
Is it the phrase, the end of a phrase, by Yivrach Adad.
Yeah.
The Ches, remember, originally it was pronounced, broadly speaking, you could say halfway between our Ashkenazic Ches and a Hey. I can't even do it. So to juxtapose that sound with a Hey sound might have been phonetically a little bit challenging. So therefore, it was truncated, the consonant fell out. The other two words, substitute references with a Hey, I'm not in that position.
Interesting point. I like that. I like that. It's interesting. It's creative.
And thank you. Follows a ches, and therefore adat. And for all we know, maybe Barry's right too. Maybe there is something going on spiritually with the name change. Not quite sure. Rabbi Orlov is making a grammatical point that's very close to my heart, because I can wrap my mind around grammar, mystical stuff, not so much, although I probably ought to start thinking about that. At all events, I like that. Vayivrach adad, and it becomes a little bit easier
right.
to say that aleph as opposed to maybe a ha following that guttural Yemenite or Moroccan. Hard to do it. Hard for Ashkenazim to do that. I hear that. Interesting point. You like that? Vayivrach adad. It's easier on the vocal cords or whatever, the throat. That's good. Thank you. So he fled. Adad fled. He and Edomite men, okay, they ran away. They were not killed, obviously. Obviously, they were not killed by Yoav in the killing fields of Edom. They ran away. They fled. And may Abdi Aviv Ito Levomitram, and he took along. He was of royal lineage. The father was the king of Edom. He took servants of his father, took court servants with him. He took palace servants with him. And where'd they go? They went to Egypt. Vahadad Na'ar Katan. And we are informed that this individual, who's later going to be an adversary to Shlomo, at this point in time, he's a little kid. He's described as Na'ar Katan. He's a little child, a small child. He's running away. They're escaping from the killing fields. They're taking the prince. The servants of the king are taking the prince, and they are running for their lives and for the life of the prince as well. I guess we have to put in that kind of a context. That's how I understand it. Yeah.
I'm confused. The positive chat. I'm confused. The
You're not the only one.
There's several. Several took him before. It says, Vayakem, Satan the Shomo, who was the Satan? Hadad. I look at Hadad already was a force to be reckoned with at that point. I can say he was young, but that he was not caught, he was a little boy, you know, that a puppet king, because he was in line for the throne. I don't know. He was like a figurehead that they put up.
Okay. My understanding is from preparation. Is that what you're reading right now is the back, we're reading the backstory.
Oh.
We're having the Bible writer introduce to us, here comes an adversary against Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see in a moment, maybe today, maybe next week, God willing, we're going to figure this out, hopefully tonight, we will see a footnote, a comment where it's going to say, that the Almighty held him in abeyance, as it were, and waited for him to grow up in order to then shtach Shlomo at the end of Shlomo's life to get back at Solomon for all that idolatry that he was allowing. So we have to wait for Hadad to grow up and become an adult. However, the Bible writer, I don't remember who wrote Malachim, the Bible maybe said, whoever the Navi was. But the writer, compiler of Malachim is introducing us now to the backstory. Shem says, I'm going to take away your kingdom from you, and I'm going to raise an adversary. And the writer says, you know who the adversary is? His name was Hadad. And you want to know his story? Ah, Yoav and David. Ah, did they kill Edomites? But this kid, he escaped. And when he grew up, then he became an adversary to Solomon. And that's your backstory. And that is my understanding as to how this whole narrative is playing out. It's a little bit involved. The narrative is involved, but this is how it's going out. Yes.
I don't think it's just... I don't think it's just waiting for him to grow up, because he couldn't have been much younger than Shlomo HaMelech. Because I don't think, you know, how old was Shlomo HaMelech when he took over the throne?
Oh, sorry, young kid, so sorry.
And David was fighting these wars probably with Edom, probably before Shlomo was even born, which would make Hadad even older than Shlomo.
Okay, you make a good point. Now, Mark, it's not easy.
Thank you. Not easy for us to know in detail perhaps how old he was. We are told that at this point of running away, Hadad Na'ar Katan, he was a kid, a young child, a small child.
Yeah, but
that's what we're told. Yes, Barry.
It's not necessarily so, but it just seems that when we use Na'ar, we're referring to the maturity level and not necessarily the chronological way.
But the word Katan is being added over there, small, young. And so that adjective seems to allow us to say, oh, he was really young. I mean, you're telling us that he's a Katan. He was a little kid. Although exactly how old he was, I'm not sure.
Well, I guess they won't tell us exactly, but we can compare it to other places where it's used Katan and get an idea. Because I've seen Na'ar used to people, you know, if they're 30 or so, as long as they are not default bias,
Who Na'ar, referring to Yosef. But I say he's like hangy with them, friendly with them, playing with them.
You took a video at the Akedah, if you accept the traditional interpretation, it was like 37.
Uh-huh. And, this, and the phrase is now over there.
Nah, right?
Right, but Yosef is 17, or
right.
So that number comes into my head.
Right.
So we've got a 37-year-old who's called a Nar, a 17-year-old who's called a Nar. The word also Nar, I think, comes up regarding Moshe Rabbeinu in the little Teva. So how does Chazal deal with that one? I mean, he's like an infant. So how much a newborn practice, or 2 months, 3 months, whatever he was, he was in the months.
Well, we need to somebody's just, on the cuts on...
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Now, so now they say that he had a voice of an older child. Of course, he's in his months. He's 3 months old, 6 months old, whatever it was. But he had the voice of a Na'ar. That's the reason why it appears over there in Moshe Rabbeinu's narrative. But the word Katan over here adds a little something. He's really young. At all events, we're going to continue, not knowing exactly how old, but he's young. And now we're in Yerches. Vayakum, now that we're going to get a little bit more backstory. We need to know even more as to how it was they got to Egypt. Vayakumu mimidjan, vayavau parat. They arose, they got up, meaning they alighted out, so they started out from Midjan. And they came to Parat. So they go from Edom, we're going to see this in the footnotes. They go from Edom, then they run to Midjan. And they go to Paran, and they go to Egypt. Vayikhu anashim imam, even though I've got it, my word says imim. That cannot possibly be. Does anybody have a different word?
Imam.
It has to be imam.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that is a typo, ship of typos.
Those aren't even...
That is weird. They would allow that through. I don't get that one. Help me. I don't know. At all events, they took men with them from Paran. We're going to see why in a minute. What are you doing canvassing men in Paran? It's like a stopover. What are you doing taking men with you? By Yavoam Mitzrayim. They finally came to Egypt. Oh, thank God my voice is getting better. Okay. Yavoam Mitzrayim, El Paro Melech Mitzrayim. They came to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Vayitin lo Vayis. And what did Paro do with this young boy? He's a young kid. He's a child, right? He is. So what did Paro do for him? Plenty. Payitim Levias.
Paro gave him housing.
Literally, he gave him a house.
He gave him a place to stay.
The Lechem Amarlo.
And bread, literally bread. He said to him, that's crazy English talk. That's not
a good translation.
He appointed for him. He arranged for him. He made arrangements, you know, verbally.
The Lechem and bread, Amarlo.
He said to him, meaning he made arrangements for that food. He got a meal plan going on for this kid.
The Eretz Nasan Lo.
And the Pharaoh gave him land. So he had it made. This is a kid who is of royal extraction of Edom. And Baruch Hashem, he goes down to Paro, and he's got it made. And it gets even better. And I'm going to read that next pasuk because it's going to boggle your mind. Then we'll do a footnote and let you go.
I also done. Yetes v'yimtza hadan chen b'nei Paro ma'ot.
Oh, this young boy, Hadad, he sure found favor in the eyes of the Pharaoh.
Ma'od, a lot, very much.
So what does Pharaoh do? He sees this young kid, likes him a lot, wants to develop a rapport, a good relationship. What do you do for a kid like that, who's the prince of Edom? Not that there's anything left of Edom. But he's the prince, you got to show respect.
Vayitin lo isha,
he gave him a wife. Watch who he gave.
Who did he give as a wife?
Pharaoh gave to this young boy, Hadad, a wife who?
Esachos isha,
the sister of his own wife. He gave his sister-in-law.
Are you listening?
He gave his sister-in-law as a wife to this young man. Who's the sister-in-law?
Achos tach penes hagevira,
the sister of tach penes, the gevira. Now we have this term we use in modern day colloquial yeshivish. He's a gevir, and it's come to mean he's wealthy.
And here she's a gevira. What does that mean?
It means a queen. And they're going to say that literally it means the mistress. Hagevira, the mistress, meaning we're going to see that not all the king's wives had the status of queen, but this one did. She had the status of being a queen. Therefore, the sister of the queen had particular esteem. He's giving away the sister of the queen. That's amazing. Alternatively, Tach Penes, this woman, was a highly esteemed woman even prior to her marriage to Pharaoh. At all events, no matter how you cut it, he's giving away his sister-in-law, who's clearly of royal extraction, to this young man who has found favor in his eyes. That's really something. And Rashi translates the word gevira, hamalka, the queen. And that's why maybe they translate it like that into the text. They follow Rashi straight up. What's funny is that when they give me the footnote, they say the queen. Hebrew, hagevira, literally the mistress. Okay, but that's not Rashi. Rashi's saying that she's a malka. She is a queen, and there must have been a lot of women running around that palace, just like in ancient times and other palaces, but she was considered the queen. Really something. We'll do one footnote, let you go. I think I got time to go to CZE. I hope so. They set out for Midian. Take a look. 18. Take a look at this footnote. They set out for Midian. You as a reader going, what? Midian? Where's Midian coming into play over here? I wonder if they're in, you know, Edom, which is like, I don't know, southern Israel. And then they're going to go to Egypt. So this I understand, Egypt, whatever. But where's the... Okay, one second. He runs away. Lavo Mitzrayim. That's what it says in 17. And he's a kid. So you're going, okay, I get it. They're going from Edom to Egypt. That's cool. But then the next pasuk says, they arise from Midian and they go to Paran. And it was going, what? Where are you getting those places from? Didn't they just go straight from you know, modern day, I don't know, southern Israel, Edom, down to Egypt, a pretty straight shot. It's a couple of days on a mule, but it's not much more than that. What are you doing with this Midian thing? Says the Abarbanel and the Matsuda, they fled from Edom to Midian. And who spent time in Midian? Which famous Jew spent time in Midian? Moshe did. And where is that? I think modern-day Jordan. I think ancient Midian is in contemporary modern-day Jordan, on that side of the the Jordan River. That's my understanding. That's where Midian was, I think. I don't think I'm off by much. There's a map. There's a map. Midian. Does anybody see it? Manasseh is on the other side. Mitzpah. So where is Midian? Aram is all the way in the north. Where is Midian? Moab is near the Yam HaMelech.
Midian has to be near Moab.
Midian has to be near Moab.
Well, I'm thinking that there were two things for Midian. One was on the far side of Moab, uh-huh. And then they conquered the other part for a while or whatever. So, what was it?
I'm going to move.
Moab conquered Midian, or was it Midian conquered Moab? Which one was?
Got to review that. There's Moab over here. There's Ammon. Ammon and Moab. But I'm not seeing Midian. And I thought Midian would be over here.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. In contemporary modern-day Jordan. Jordan is pretty big. This is a small part of it. I thought Midian was over there. And that's where, you know, Moshe was tending sheep. That's what I thought. I don't think I'm off by much. At all events, that they're trying to, the writer is explaining to us, they set out from Midian. They fled from Edom to Midian. They went north. And from Midian, they went to Paran. Can I continue? And they took men with them from Paran. Hadad recruited men in Paran. Why did he do that? According to the footnote, to enhance his prestige in Egypt. So says the Abarbanel and the Matsuda again. And the Radak maintains that these men were acquaintances of his who could testify before Pharaoh that he was indeed of royal descent. This guy, Paro, he really is a prince. We know this. We're aware of him. We know, you know, of him, of his father. We know the court guys and the servants. And these men were acquaintances, and they'd be able to testify. He really is a prince. And then Paro assigned them sustenance. Belechem, Omar lo. So now Rashi is going to play on this Omar, he said. What does it mean he said? He said bread? What does it mean he said bread to him? Because an interesting way to phrase it. So in English we say he assigned him bread. He arranged for him a meal. Rashi says, I like that word lomar, to say. I like that verb. Says Rashi, he said to his attendants, so much bread shall you give him every day. That shot, he said to him. He said to his attendants, feed this guy a certain amount every single day. Others explain that he promised to supply him with food. So says the Targum Yonason, the Radak, and the Matsuda. And gave him land, and we'll finish with this. The Eretz Nasam lo, he gave him land. He made him a ruler over a number of cities. Paro is incredible. Look at this. Magnanimous gesture. He gives this kid, one minute he never saw the guy before. The next minute he's giving him food. He's giving him cities to rule over, says the Radak and the Rabat. And then the next minute he gives his sister-in-law. Wow. I'm just amazed. Alternatively, in addition to giving him a house in which to live, I'm going to go that route. He gave him a house. And he didn't give him cities. He just gave him a house. But okay. In addition to that, he gave him, presented him with an estate, which his descendants would inherit, says the Matsuda. He gave him a whole estate, a good chunk of land that would be a good Yerusha for his children and grandchildren. And that's another way to understand the Eretz Nasan Lo. He gave him land. It doesn't just mean a little house. It means a good piece of land that his children would inherit. Or it could mean he gave him a rulership over a number of cities. However you define that phrase, the Eretz Nasan Lo, he gave him land. However, a house, a large chunk of land, cities, whatever it is,
he gave him tremendous respect. And he topped it off by giving his own sister-in-law. That really, to me, that really kind of takes the cake. At all events, we are there. Thank God. At around 8:30. I want to thank everybody for showing up tonight. God willing, I'm going to be hopefully on the road next week. Our travel plans have changed a little bit, but we might be going to Detroit for a few days and enjoy what there is to see up there. And so I'm not going to be here live to give the class, and I like doing that. So let us take a little break next week. We're smack in the middle of chapter 11, so people continue reading through to the end of chapter 11 and go a little bit more, and we will reconvene as soon as I come back from the road as we can. The next week also might be on the road, so it's not so clear. I'll keep everybody posted. I want to thank everybody for showing up tonight. Thank you so much, Barry and Reverend Mrs. Burrell. Thank you very much to all of you for your comments and additions. A big Yishar Koyach. Continue your limud of the Sefer. Have a great week, everybody. Enjoy, and all the best, and have a good one. Bye-bye.
It was part of the death.